I'm Jeff, and this is My World. This podcast is about getting to know my friends better by reading a book with them and discussing it. Some of these friends read a lot, some read a little, and some, honestly, I'm not sure can read, but we'll find out, that's for sure. Today's guest reader is Mike. We've been roommates for over a year and have known each other for about 2 years. He's from the left coast, he's a gamer, likes to grow things, and is an engineer of some sort, which I always get it wrong. Say hi, Mike.
Hi.
So what kind of engineer are you?
Electrical
Electrical,
engineer.
Damn it. I know it's not. I've got an uncle who's a textile engineer.
Oh, unusual.
And I know 2 software engineers, but I'm always like, I know he's not one of those two, but I don't ever remember which one it is.
People think I'm a software engineer.
Okay, I don't really know what electrical engineers do other than like
all
systems.
Sorts of things.
Okay.
All sorts of different things. I make circuit boards pretty much most of my job.
All right. Do you, like, design them, or do you just, like, put them together?
Both design them. I don't actually make them out of scratch, but when they come in, I get to put all the little tiny pieces on.
Okay,
lots of soldering.
All right. So, an electrical engineer. I will probably not remember that, but I will pretend I'm going to.
All right.
So, we are going to discuss the first 2 books of the Hyperion Cantos, Hyperion and the Fall of Hyperion. How long have you known Alex?
Started living together junior year of college, about 6 or 7
six
years.
6 or 7 years. Okay. So he bought those books for the house.
Yeah.
And when I asked him which books I should read, he bought us 4 books from 2 different series.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him which ones I should read, and he said, you need to read those first.
Yeah.
And so I read them, and I was like, oh my God, everyone needs to read these books. And then I read them last year sometime. I'm not sure how. Maybe this
time
last
year. Yeah, because we got
them
Christmas the year before last. Right.
Yeah, and I think I read them not long after that because he was like, those are the ones you should read. And he was not wrong.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay, so now everyone else needs to read these because I need someone to talk to about them. And then I was able to sucker you into doing this lovely podcast.
That's how viruses work.
Yeah. And so what it's going to be... It's going to be hard for me. We were just discussing this. It'll be hard for me because I've read the follow-up 2 novels. So there's 4 books.
Yeah.
And the
try to distinguish.
Yeah. And the good part is, though, is they're like 280 years into the future. There's one big thing where I'm like, okay, I don't remember when that was revealed, so I'm just going to not talk about it. Fingers crossed. Unless you bring it up, then I can be like, yay! Right.
Good, because we'll see. There were a lot of open-ended pieces from the books that I was still like, what? When it ended, and they didn't wrap it up at all. And it was kind of like, okay, either that's shoddy storytelling, or this is like, he's leaving it for later.
And I felt like that when I finished them, first 2, and I don't remember if all of it's wrapped up.
Oh, God.
I feel like some of it is supposed to just be left open-ended.
Yeah.
Which is, it's good and bad, I think. So, like, So, I don't know, it's very...
We'll get to it.
Yeah, we will.
Yeah.
But let's start with the broader questions that I have. So, the first one is, how do you look at science fiction and fantasy, and where do you sort of see this one?
Well, my benchmark for sci-fi is definitely Star Trek.
Okay.
Grew up with Next Gen, and then Voyager was the big one, really. So I guess that definitely sets the stage. Now, in terms of tech, like, this has some things that are beyond and some things that are behind. Like, for example, the Farcasters are obviously the, like, most godlike technology.
Yeah.
But then they don't have stuff like replicators. They don't really have what else.
But I'm glad you said that, though, because for me, the big division between fantasy and science fiction, and it's the line definitely gets blurred for me. The science fiction, it is the technology.
Yeah.
And it's like the high tense, and they don't necessarily have to go into how the technology works, and he does that in these 2 novels. And each novel he goes into it super specific at one point, and I'm just kind of like, oh my God, this is killing me. But it's the technology versus like the fantasy. To me, like, I sort of think of Star Wars almost as more fantasy than science fiction, because it's about the politics and the people and the discovering new places.
Yeah, plus there are tons of like vistas that are on the magical side of things, as opposed to like the, like, it's explained and like this is how it works, or at least to say that we know how it works and then leave it at that is like the sci-fi side of things for me, but if they're just like, there's this incredible thing that's happening, and they just kind of visually describe it,
yeah,
that's more fantasy, well, that's in my opinion. And I actually got into an argument with Alex over this. What's the difference between science fiction and fantasy? I don't remember.
I don't want to have that conversation with him.
I don't
want
to bring it up. So, yeah, I'll let you, yeah.
Oh, okay, so note not to read science fiction or fantasy with Alex. We will do a classic. But yeah, it is. It's very, it's hard because it's, you know, you want it to be very crisp and then it's not. But then this one, it had the mixture of the both.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And I think even more so in the second duology, I don't know what it's called, that felt even more fantastical and fantasy-like because it was very, it was about exploring the world. Whereas this one, there's this super tight focus. You still have all of the other worlds,
very
but it's all about
driven.
Yeah, the character driven, but also the technology of the Farcasters and the
AI,
web.
the world web. Yeah,
And then the AIs and the Technicore. So it's kind of like, but even then he's created, is it Dan Simmons?
Yeah, Dan Simmons.
He's created this like fantasy within the technology.
Yeah.
So it's like it's on so many levels, and I think that's it just. I don't know, it blew my mind as I was reading these two books. The man, I don't know if he's a genius, but he's very, very smart.
Yeah, you can tell he's worked out these ideas to, like, near philosophical depths. It's pretty impressive.
And just sort of, like, the throwaway lines that he had in there. I know when I wrote about the first one, Hyperion, in my blog, he mentioned Clovis technology. And it's stone technology, so stone tools. And I was like, just to throw away something like that, provide no context, nothing. Like, he didn't.
Yeah.
It was just kind of like, they hadn't seen this since the Clovis age or something. And, like, the only reason I knew that is because I was an anthropology major. But it was just kind of like, wait
totally
a minute.
Yeah, I totally missed that right in my head.
Yeah, but it made me see, like, it made me wonder what all I was missing.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I got a lot of the literary references. I got that one random anthropological, archaeological reference. But I was just kind of like, what all has this man included in here, and especially the philosophy.
Yeah,
and maybe it's the second one. One of his big influences is a philosopher, and I was like, no idea who that is.
Well, so he talks about, obviously Keats is the, like, inspiration for this freaking thing, and then there were a few other ones that I totally am forgetting, but yeah, he does mention a few other poets and philosophers as being like part of this whole mythos of the, like, weird, like, collision of the future and the present going forward.
Well, and also of pulling in the past. Like,
yeah.
The whole Keats,
like,
clones or copies. Yeah, reconstructions.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah, I love that idea because that's something I haven't actually seen in a lot of other sci-fi things. And I don't have a huge exposure, to be fair. I'm sure it's been done elsewhere. But, I thought that was pretty novel that he was bringing people basically to life, resurrecting them out of history.
From their history and then building their personality through their writings, which
Yeah.
I don't know how you do that with some schizophrenic writers that are just kind of like, oh, super happy, oh, super sad, super morbid.
Yeah, James Joyce.
Maybe that would provide an even rounder character, whereas, like, Keats' characters had deficiencies of some sort.
Yeah.
But it also added, like, the humanity to them.
Right.
So you kept forgetting they were cybrids.
Right, and that was another, like, interesting thing that he did, because they're not just, like, perfect copies. They're people that have been sort of, like, pressed into this mold of another persona from another time and given their DNA to, I think, which
that part was
totally
creepy.
Yeah. Creepy and also like, I don't know. Like, didn't the Earth blow up and, like, did somebody just happen to bring along some bone sample?
Oh, I'm sure. But it blew up after the expansion.
Right. Did it blow up? We should talk about that later if you don't have
We'll talk about that later. Right. But it is, that question continues throughout all four books.
Okay, good. Like, because that was one of those things that at the end I was like, come on, like, how could you not wrap that up? Like,
yeah, and So I've taken to the point of not, we're going to go in a different direction, then we'll go back.
Okay.
I've taken to the point of not reading series at the moment until they're all out. Like, I could not imagine reading this, so the 1990 for Hyperion, 91 for Fall of Hyperion, and then I think there were 5 or 6 years, may have been as few as 2, but it's still, that is a long time to wait.
Yeah.
But given the big jump, you can see them as 2 separate series, but there are those unanswered questions, like, what about Earth? What about the characters? Like, okay, so-and-so survives. So-and-so we don't think does. So-and-so definitely doesn't.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of like,
what?
Yeah, I feel like if I'm going to invest it, I want at least the whole thing to be done.
Right, you want the payoff at the end. You want things
Yeah.
to, like, okay, I've spent two books, like, waiting to know what happens to this person and, like, who they really are.
And these are not small books.
No.
About 1,000 pages. The other two are also 1,000 pages. So it's an investment.
Yeah, especially for a slow reader like me.
Yeah, I read fast. So
Yeah,
it was not fun.
what, it was 2 days for you? 2 days per book.
It was less than a week.
Oh
But
my God.
that part of that was they sucked me in.
Oh
But
yeah.
that's so how did you feel with that first one starting in the middle of everything?
Oh yeah.
And it's a very common plot device, but I had when I was looking back, I was like, I remember that distinctly it caused me issues.
Yeah.
Because it was like, what? I don't know what's going on. Like,
Right, you're like, ah, you have this sort of sense of just being thrown into the story
yeah.
because you don't know who anybody is, but they and they don't really know each other either, which helps.
Yeah, and they're starting to learn, and that's the one reason that I didn't feel so lost.
Yeah, but the I actually had a really hard time getting started because of that, because the prologue is this whole introduction to the consul who's sort of the not narrator but sort of the like mainest character.
Yeah, he's the compiler in that first
Right.
novel.
Yeah. So you get this prologue and he gets like this call to Hyperion and I swear those first few pages were just like ugh. Like I can't like they're talking about all the shit that I that is they're not explaining what it is and
Yeah,
I'm
and
just like
that's it. It was the language. So like I think I didn't realize that Tau City Center was TC
TC2.
squared
Yeah. For
until
so
like
long.
300 pages in.
Yeah.
Maybe longer. I was like, what do they keep referring to this
Why? What are
as?
these two planets?
Yeah, and there was one other one that really just got to me. But it was good and bad. Like
Yeah.
it was like, well, you
It's like
just dove right
so much
in.
jargon. Ah.
Yeah, but you dove right in, so like you were already kind of near where the action was getting ready to happen,
Yeah.
and you didn't have to deal with it, but you didn't know enough to be able to deal with it, I felt.
Yeah.
If there was one critique for me, that was the biggest thing that I struggled with was getting into it. But as soon as you
Yeah.
got past probably 50 or 100
Yeah,
pages.
the fir even the first few pages into Lenar Hoyt's story, which is the first of the people's stories, that is, that was like, okay, this is cool.
Yeah,
Like, I
and you just
really.
get like really sucked into it.
Yeah.
Now, have you ever read The Canterbury Tales?
I have not.
You have
No.
not? Not even in school?
Mm-mm.
No. Oh, so that's one of the
I know this is a
reasons.
reference to that, but.
Yeah, and one of the reasons that I'm like, this man is so smart is that he's mirroring the Canterbury Tales. Like, he's just like, we're gonna go on a pilgrimage, we're gonna share our stories. And, you know, there's obviously major differences, but I was just like, what? And that being said, that's just the first novel.
Yeah.
Did you find it different, the complete? So we're talking about these as one continuous story.
Yeah, which it is.
Yeah, did you find that shift change, though, from the narrative style of the first book of
Yeah.
here's my story, this is what happened, and then all of a sudden we start in the second book and we're hearing solely from Akeet's character?
Yeah, except
Is it
so
John
I
Stearns?
actually
I think something like that. Stearns, something Stearns.
Severn.
Severn, okay.
Joseph Severn. Yeah, it was weird getting started in the second one because I pretty much finished the first one and started the second one right away, and it took me a lot longer to get used to the style of the second one,
Yeah.
even though the action happens like more consistently,
Yeah.
because the first one there's a lot of kind of dead time,
Yeah, a lot
a
of
lot
waiting
of
around, a
yeah,
lot
what feels
of.
like filler.
You can tell that it's a pilgrimage.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of humming and hawing. I don't.
Yeah.
There's got to be another word for
Yeah.
it than that.
They do a lot of exposition.
Yeah, okay,
Yeah.
there we go. Better than humming and hawing.
Yeah, but so in the first one it's more of this sort of like you meet each character and you start from the beginning of their story and you go basically up till the present when they're taking the pilgrimage. So it's this sort of continuous like, okay, start here, go to present, start, go to the end. Whereas the second one, it jumps all over the place and you're following five or six different bases or people,
Yeah.
and it kind of changes because they all like overlap and intermix, and that got a little disconcerting. It's not quite the right word, but
Discombobulating.
yeah,
I just like
yeah,
that
because
word.
they end, the and I think the chapters are a lot shorter.
I
Because it
think so
feels
too.
like they end and they switch back and forth so rapidly that you're like, kind of wanted a little bit more continuity there. Again, in terms of action, the second book is like way more gratifying.
Yeah, I can see. I can see that. I think I liked the tales because it provided so much back setting and
Yeah, and you really
storytelling.
get introduced to the world and the universe,
Yeah.
really.
And that first one stayed with me longer than the second one. Now, a character from the second one, and she's in the first one, Nick Gladstone.
Oh.
I was like, okay, I don't trust you, I don't like you, but you're
Yeah.
very interesting, and we're gonna
Yeah.
see where you go. Just their stories sort of go through all the novels. Like you're still finding out fun, interesting fun. In quotation marks,
Fun
fun.
facts.
Fun facts about these characters, even in the last novels, 300 years later.
Oh.
So yeah, so it's very interesting. So
Yeah.
how did you, one of the last sort of general question before we dive into what you really liked about the book specifically and what I liked about the book specifically,
Yeah.
how did you feel about these two books and how they set up the machines against humanity, the religious aspect?
Yeah.
It's not as I can tell you that what happens in these books and the setup, it's almost the exact opposite in the next two novels.
Really?
And that's not a spoiler. Like it's kind of leading up to that, and you
I
sort of
think I know what you
expect
mean.
that to happen.
Yeah.
And I won't say anything more specific in case it is a little bit of a spoiler, but it is. It's kind of like everything that's happening now. You have the hegemony and the Church of Final Atonement, and then you have the AI and the core, and then out here you've got the ousters, which I think are they were
Yeah.
I wanted to learn more about them.
Yeah, I know. Oh my God. And do they come up more in the follow-on two books? Because if they don't, I would be pissed.
I'm pretty sure they do.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure they're
'Cause they only really got like realized as characters in the last few chapters.
yeah, and maybe the last 50 pages.
Yeah.
And they were just like just the way he described them, like the ones with the wings and the really tall ones. It was like, I want to talk about this. Those are really interesting.
Yeah.
They do actually. There's a lot more. You learn a lot more about them. What's sort of happening at the end of this one, like where the invasion, that whole ouster invasion that's proven false, there's more around all of that in the
Yeah.
next two novels.
Wow.
So
Yeah.
because they lose the ability to forecast at the end of this, well, the ousters refuse to use it for good reason, I think. But because the hegemony loses the ability to forecast, you then have people that have to travel for, 50, 100 years to get to the next place, and the ousters are just evolving naturally how they want and traveling, and humans, they're all humans, but
Yeah.
humans as we know them find other ways to do that.
Yeah.
So it does, and you learn more about them, and you learn how they live and that sort of thing, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, so
Okay, so we'll pick that back up later, but back to religion and this whole like technology versus
yeah.
humanity thing. I thought that they did a really good job of it, especially considering this was written in 1990, and it's
Yeah.
this that's like the internet was a thing, but
A very small thing, yeah.
just barely. And to have the sort of like extensive data sphere and have it be pervasive throughout the entire world web culture, to the point that they're like incredibly dependent on it.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Like that he saw that and that he like made that as part of this future.
Now, have you ever read The Handmaid's Tale?
No.
It's not set as far into the future.
Yeah.
She wrote it in the 80s, and it's set in like early like 2020s or something.
Yeah.
And it's similar where it's like technology has become all pervasive, but then that's how they take over. And that's sort of what happens with this. So we've got,
Yeah.
the big crux of the story is the techno core good or bad? And we find out part of the fantastical side of that, which I found fascinating, is that it's not just one techno core,
Yeah,
it's got
it's
the
its whole
three
like s
warring
separate
factions.
society and right, and they're at each
Yeah.
other's throats.
But that leads to a broader question. So one, they're all trying to just either destroy each other or create a godlike interface, the UI, I don't remember what that stands for,
Ultimate intelligence.
ultimate intelligence. Or they're just kind of like, no, we need to keep working with the humans. So you've got this whole side story going on, which
Yeah.
definitely continues.
Cool.
You find out a little bit more. It doesn't continue like super, super.
Yeah, well, at the end of Fall of Hyperion, they make it seem like it might have just been destroyed completely.
Yeah, so, but then
Which.
there's the follow-up message which says you'll get the flat line, so the communicating device,
Yeah.
you'll get that back when you figure out how to sort shit
Yeah.
out,
Yeah.
basically.
Which was one of those totally ridiculous things that I mentioned before that I
yeah, you're like, who, what, yeah, why, what? Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's yeah.
Was this sloppy writing, or are you like teasing the hell out of me?
Yes, right, or are you just pissing everybody off? No, mm-hmm. and you do find out sort of how that's connected. There's also, oh, there's so much more, because it is, he blurs even more so in the next novel. He blurs technology and spirituality and, I guess, miraculousness, like the ability. So, like, the Farcasters come back. Like, they don't come back, they don't necessarily come back on, but they play a big role.
Yeah.
And you're kind of like, well, how, huh? So, like, you think all the technology is gone and it's missing because the techno core is supposedly extinct.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you're just kind of like, well, then how is this happening? You know, recently, sometime in the last month, I read something, you know, Stephen Hawking once again said, artificial intelligence is a bad idea. We shouldn't be working towards it.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on this?
Oh, my God. I think Stephen Hawking is kind of, how do I put this? Sensationalist.
Okay.
But he's got, I mean, like, not to get too much on that bandwagon. He's got a lot of stake in kind of like stirring up that controversy, and I like it because it gets people to think about these things.
Yeah.
And that's like what I love about scientists that are that public, like him and Neil deGrasse Tyson. Yeah. Because they kind of refocus people's thoughts and interests on what could be really cool about the future instead of just like petty squabbling and social differences, but anyway.
And it's interesting because Hawkins was an influence, like
the
Hawking Drive
is their base technology. Yeah, and I can just imagine Dan Simmons reading A Brief History of Time, Stephen Hawking's like explanation of the universe, and being like, whoa, all these things, and then that is kind of part of what led to this, and then he read Hyperion or the Canterbury Tales or whatever. Clearly, guy read a lot of very disparate genres. I think the way that he sets up the technology in this and the sort of development of humanity with technology is accurate as far as what I would expect.
I think I agree. My only, I don't know about the AI.
Yeah.
I'm both fascinated and terrified about it.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like if we were able to create it and turn it on in a kind of like the Truman Show, like when he's in an enclosed
little bubble world,
So like if in a finite area, and then if it got too smart and you could like get rid of it, shut it down, I'm like, that would be really cool. But then at the same time, I'm kind of like, well, Truman got out, why would Nick get out?
And that's this whole debate over like what is the singularity and like what is the nature of artificial intelligence, and knowing what I know about computer science, which is not as much as you might think. Machine learning and artificial intelligence is still sort of primitive. And I mean that not to say that it's like not powerful. I mean that we're not really close to replicating like human style intelligence.
Yeah.
Like the things that computers are really good at are still totally different from the things that like people and animal brains are really good at. So to think about them as being sort of the same type of intelligence doesn't really make sense right now.
Yeah.
But I think given how interested people are in doing that, that's going to happen eventually.
Well, I'm sure. Now, was it in this novel where they talk about where the AI core starts and how it started?
No.
Okay.
They go reference it.
In depth into how it starts in the next two sets, because they talk about the person who was trying to do it and how he did it.
Yeah.
So I don't know technologically or scientifically if it's possible to do it the way that he's writing about it. It sounded like a feasible option to me, like that you just trial and error until all of a sudden something mutates and it happens. So kind of like life.
Right.
That part of the next two novels is really interesting.
Yeah. I'm curious to see if he gets into this, because you always think about like AI as being just the sort of construct of intelligence, but you don't really think about the physical hardware that it operates on.
Mm-hmm.
And that totally matters, because it informs, I mean, the same way that our biological circuitry informs like how we perceive the world, like the semiconductor machinery of computers like informs how they're able to process data.
But I think that's sort of how it comes to in that it's not going to be a machine in the way we think of it being artificial intelligence so much as it's going to be a software, which is really interesting. So, like, I'm sure you've seen the preview for Chappie, which is like, oh, that sounds really cool. Where they just, like, change some transistors around, and then it's like, oh, you're smart, you're human.
Yeah.
He's trying to create, like, chromosomes within a software
program. So, right, so you sort of simulate this into existence from the very base, like, little
And then it DNA builds its own... So within, like, the software program that then builds its own, or within, maybe at that point it's like the internet, it, like, builds its own intelligence, and then it designs.
So it is the singularity where it's smart enough to build a better intelligence.
The, you know, the reason the Farcaster shut down is because Gladstone's like, nope. Figured that one out.
Yeah, and again, and I think this will be, what, three or four to the of those things that was like, I don't know if that was a smart choice or, like, sloppy writing and it just needed to happen, because, like, I want to know more about how that happened.
Yeah, and you do. You definitely find out more about that. Okay. And I think it's, like, right as soon as you start the next novel. Like, you're kind of like, huh? No, it's not, because there's a weird introduction in the next one as well. And I thought that was really interesting because the AI characters that are in the novel, above it all, they're, like, above everyone else, it's like we're deigning our presence to come to you.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, they're... I don't remember where... In which of the two of these two novels it happens, but one of the humanoid characters says the AI gave the humans basically the blueprints for the Farcasters. So they built their own downfall, which is like, I guess that's when it comes down to technology. That's probably my bigger fear, more so than AI, is like, you've seen WALL-E, right?
Yeah.
Like the fat people and like the screens. And with all of our cell phones and our computers, and that's more scary.
What's that demon?
Than anything else.
I'm gonna say Belphegor, the demon who lures humanity into
screen death.
Sloth through technology.
I would not be surprised.
Matt has explained this to me a few times. It's a pretty interesting mythos, but I digress.
But you could see that happening.
Yeah.
Like, it's not hard to imagine when you're on the bus or on the T, and everyone there has a phone.
Oh my God, everybody's, like, totally zoned into their own little device.
Okay, the last thing before we get to, like, talk about specific characters, I mean, we've already done that anyway.
Yeah.
What did you think about his view of humanity and the hegemony expanding and whitewashing, so like human washing the universe?
Oh, yeah.
Do you see that happening?
I mean, I think that's prescient. I don't know how practical it is, honestly, though, because this whole book, they kind of ignore how much of a barrier space and time are. And it's set so far in the future that the world web has already been established, and there's basically no transition time from planet to planet through the Farcaster network. But getting to that point, you don't have, like, a gradual transition into, you know, culture being pervasive, whereas now, where cultures bleed into each other, more dominant cultures, just by virtue of the fact that they're the more powerful consumers, kind of drive the market. So that validates this point of view. The hegemony, their culture kind of just, like, overtaking everything, especially in the Maui Covenant story.
Yeah, and I think that is the one that stood out for me. Yeah. It was heartbreaking. And then for them to realize afterward that the dolphins were intelligent. And I mean, like, the Maui Covenant natives knew they were intelligent, but the hegemony was just like, no, we want to bring tourism, we want to bring you into the web.
Yeah.
It's imperialism all over.
Yeah, oh yeah. There are total overtones of, you know, the American colonial period, and it especially, I mean, Maui obviously reminds you of Hawaii and what happened there, and I don't know the history there too well.
For me, it's even more, it's Spanish colonialism when they came to...
The Caribbean.
The Caribbean. 4 years of studying, and I don't remember the name of the tribe. I think it's the Tainos.
Okay.
They were on, I think they were the natives on Puerto Rico.
Oh.
And they completely died out.
Yeah.
So, like, they just, you know, and it's the same thing that happened with the American Indians.
Yeah, displacement, whether intentional or not.
Just anything, whereas I felt this one, was more militaristic.
Mm.
Like, it was very much like, we are going to go in, if there are humans like us, we will subsume them or they will die.
And not just humans, either. And this is one thing that doesn't really come up very often. They throw a few references to it, especially in the second book, where they're like, oh, there were these other alien species that we encountered, and then just, they happened to die out, or like...
Yeah, if you're human, you will come in.
Right.
If you are not, you will disappear or fade away.
Yeah.
The only one I wasn't really sure about was Het Mastin, the true voice of the tree.
Yeah, and what...
I couldn't tell if he...
disappointment on that story.
Yeah, I couldn't tell if he was human or not.
Like, right.
Because they kept... the way they talked about him...
They
so
only
many,
ever refer to him as a Templar, so...
Yeah, and I read so many of the Star Wars novels... growing up, that the Ithorians, they had like the tree planets, and mm-hmm. their planet was like super, super tall trees, and they hung out there. So I just sort of imagined him looking like that.
Yeah.
But then, like, now that we're talking about it and I'm thinking about it, I'm like, no, he was probably just a human.
He
with,
must
like,
have been a human.
A mask or something.
But, like, right. But they were all tall, and they had like very specific features. I think that was just an attribute or set of attributes that they got from their particular sort of branch off of humanity.
Yeah.
Like the Lucians. Were all short and super muscular, and I don't think they really characterized any others.
But that is a great scene, though. I'm thinking of Bronn.
Yeah.
When she runs through all the Farcasters, and she's
that
like...
That fight scene.
Oh, so much more gravity here, and then all of a sudden she's like bounding along.
Right.
But that is true. I think the Lucians were the only other ones, because they were so distinct.
Mm-hmm.
The Templars were very willowy. Mm-hmm. But I also sort of viewed the Templars as a religion.
Yeah, and it is this weird, like, culture, nationality, even, I don't want to say subspecies, because that's a little too dramatic, but they do have their own...
And a very distinct culture.
Yeah.
Culture is the
best
way to say. So those are all the broader questions that we've actually talked about a lot. Who were you most fascinated by? Like, which character? I have two.
Yeah.
But I wasn't sure, like, if you...
Oh, man.
And there are a lot. Like, I mean, there are the eight pilgrims, if you count the baby.
Yeah.
Rachel.
I mean, whatever, spoiler alert. She happens to be Moneta later on.
Oh, so fascinating.
What?
I saw it coming.
I mean,
figured it out. And I don't know why I figured it out. I think you learn more about her.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember. I think in the next.
I had a little trouble with that one because they didn't resolve how exactly the Merlin sickness was conferred and how it resolved and just what exactly was the point of it all.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if you saw this. I know when I was brushing up today,
mm-hmm.
apparently the Merlin sickness was when she went to sleep, she lost 2 days. And I didn't realize it was that like specific. And I mean, given this is Wikipedia, and I don't know how trustworthy it is.
Yeah, this might be a fan theory.
Yeah, but I was just kind of like, huh, I just thought she was aging backwards.
Yeah.
Huh. But I guess that would be a 1-to-1.
Right.
So if I were awake today.
1 step forward, 2 steps back.
Yeah. That does definitely seem very unresolved.
Mm-hmm.
But you do find out later. Her timeline was by far the most confusing because her and Khalid.
Kassad.
They're both moving forward and backwards simultaneously.
Yeah.
While also still moving forwards and backwards.
Yeah, so like, it's sort of these discrete, like, jumps, like, they'll move, and then, like, jump further back.
And they both live...
So they always perceive time going forward, but they can jump backwards and, like, lose stuff.
Yes.
I guess. I don't
know. As she's going forward, she's jumping back into the other timelines.
Oh.
And then Kassad moves forward... until one point, the tomb incident, and then he goes really far forward, and then he comes back, and it's just kind of
so
like
he's not dead.
I don't think so.
Because at the end of the book, they kind of insinuate that
he's in the tomb.
Dead. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's not dead.
Oh.
And that's not a spoiler. Like he
yeah, because whatever.
Because they're the time tombs.
Yeah.
So and though that's a whole other mindfuck of
time.
Like they are actually so. With the tomb that he's in is from so far forward.
Yeah.
That he's now, like, it's moving its way back to it being built again.
Were they all sent back at the same time?
I don't think they ever answer that. They might have, like, answered it in passing.
In the second book, they make reference to in the future when it's all, like, the time tombs have been, like, built and now they're, like, sending them back into the past, which is... a weird way to think about time travel. Made it sound like they were all built at the same time, but it definitely didn't say that explicitly.
I want to say yes, and I think it's all connected to the ousters.
Yeah.
And it's all connected.
It seemed like it.
It's like the post-Farcaster isolation of Hyperion, because it's pretty far out. Like,
yeah.
It's one of the
the outback worlds.
Yeah, so I want to say yes. I think they're all built and constructed at the same time. So once all the Ousters come to Hyperion, and then it's kind of like, huh, what's going on? And I think at that point something happens.
Yeah.
Then they all sort of, they're like big commemorative things, and that's why you think, you know, he's in one of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, so.
So, okay, back to the question, which was favorite or most interesting character.
Yeah.
Of the main characters, I really like Bronn.
Yep.
She's a total badass, and also I feel like the voice of the audience kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because, like,
she calls them on their bullshit.
She totally does, especially Martin Salinas, who can be a pompous asshole most of the time.
He's one of those that you hate to love, but you love to hate. Like, he's got that, like, he's so required. And what's great, and this isn't, you see it in the second novel, the relationship they build.
Yeah.
It strangely worked.
Yeah, it did. And I think that's a testament to both of them, but more Bronn's character, that they have this ability to, like, go past whatever petty differences they have.
Yeah. Now, what's the last thing you remember about Bronn?
Leading up to the end of the book, she gets, like, incapacitated and is, like, weirdly plugged into the whatever datasphere, metasphere, megasphere thing.
That's
then
right.
She comes back. Then she, like, goes to find Martin because she'd, like, left him in the city.
She left him in Keats and she went somewhere else.
Yeah. So she, like, goes back to find him. But then, like, I don't remember how she ends up here, but she ends up in one of the tombs that turns out to be, like, encasing all of these unconscious people that are also hooked in the way she was. So she goes and finds Martin, who was, like, impaled on the tree, but it turns out that maybe they're just in this weird simulation thing.
It's like a stasis chamber.
Yeah.
And they've been put into the simulation is just in their brain that they're impaled.
Right.
Yeah.
So she goes and finds him and, like, breaks him free, basically. And then the Shrike shows up and they have this weird, very short showdown where she basically, like, summons some mystical power and then just, like, wins. I don't know. She's like, stop.
Right.
And he, like, and the Shrike just, like, ceases to function. It was,
he falls off the, like, the cliff or something.
Right. Yeah. The weird, like, invisible platform. That whole scene, while very cool, left me very confused.
Okay, so that explains what I wanted to know because I didn't want to spoil anything.
And that's where I left Bronn.
You learn more about that.
Mm.
You learn more about Martin and Bronn's relationship in the next novel. It may not be at the beginning, but it's in the first few chapters, and it explains a lot more. Because there was something big that I was like, oh, I don't remember which of the four novels it happened in. And you find out why she's able to do that. And it sort of it sets the scene for the next 1,000 pages.
Yeah.
But I agree. She is by far the most badass character. And then, like, you're also, I mean, I was a little bit disappointed in the next two novels and the role she played.
Yeah.
That you find out that she played.
Hmm.
And I was kind of like, really? Sexism? Misogyny? Really? I don't know.
It was the 90s. Like, the late 80s. Whatever.
When he was ready. And it's hard to think about that now because it's been 25 years.
Yeah. And there's not a whole lot of sexism in this book considering the few examples that come up.
Excuse me. Well, it's funny because I think goes back to the whole fantasy and sci-fi thing is I think fantasy is such an open genre.
Mm-hmm.
Fantasy books often have LGBT characters or same-sex relationships that are not defined well before it's common in the media or in the mass popular culture media.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting. And then, like you're saying, there is no, and it might have been me reading into it, but it's like when you read it, you'll be like, oh, that's what he's talking about.
Yeah. Okay.
Because it is, it's also archetypical.
Mm-hmm.
It's to be expected.
Yeah.
Regardless of the time period. So it's kind of like, really, that's what you chose to do. Kind of like how you have the penitent father with Saul and Rachel.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's sort of like, it's not completely shocking. You're not expecting it. Before we switch to the last part.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts on Mina Gladstone?
Oh,
like, I know you were sort of,
yeah, conflicted. I guess I just went back and forth on her a lot. And I think for the most part, I found her to be perfect for her role, which, I mean, she was written that way. I was really happy at the end when they revealed that, like, oh, she was, like, conspiring with Bronn's dad,
mm-hmm.
Senator Lamia to, like, try to bring down the Technocore the whole time. She had some weird spots, though. Walking the Worlds thing in the second book was like, okay. But I guess she was an insomniac and they do weird stuff.
And it makes you think, like, one, I thought it was awesome that they gave a woman that much power.
Yeah.
Like, they put her, she was the most powerful person in the universe. But I also thought it was very interesting that they gave her, you know, I mean, they had, Bronn's father had to die in order for her to
ascend,
to find her own story. I didn't know whether to read it as a critique that when the Farcasters fell, when she made that decision for them to fall, as, you know, like, original sin and the woman destroying it, or, like, just sort of, like, this woman making this ultimate sacrifice, like, knowing she was breaking families and friends and destroying the worlds as they were known.
Yeah, that's kind of the lesser of two evils choice, and I think she definitely chose correctly, because the alternative was let the invasion continue and basically wipe everybody out, right?
Which invasion?
The ouster, but really Technocore invasion.
True. Yeah.
So like that was the.
But that makes me wonder, because it was not. I don't think there was an invasion. Like, there were physical manifestations of this invasion, but I think it was more them trying to trigger the Technocore, trying to get
the ousters,
the hegemony, to trigger an attack on the ousters to then create ultimate human annihilation. So, like, for them to destroy each other.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, okay.
Right. So that's
the way you said it. I was thinking, no. Yeah.
No, but, right. Yeah. It wasn't an invasion. That the bad word. It was an extermination, really. Yeah. So their only choice was to like try to shut down the Technocore. I would say it was almost too closely guarded of a secret, because it was to the point where it felt like the writer kind of didn't figure it out himself.
Until they sort of slapped it on.
Right.
But with her being a politician,
you
could sort of see that she had just sort of held it.
Yeah. Yeah, but they never. I would have liked more reference to motivation.
Yeah. Book,
but maybe I just missed it.
Now that we know how that ends, I bet going back, you would see a lot more. So I'm sure you've reread Harry Potter.
Oh, yeah.
It's like when you go back, you see at the end of the fourth book, he mentions Mrs. Fig.
Yeah.
So Harry's neighbor. You're just kind of like, and I definitely didn't catch that the first time. So, like, I have a feeling if we went back and read these, we would see, like, little hints to it. Yeah, where you'd be like, oh, shit, you're such a you're so much more of an author than I thought you were, and you were kind of a badass author.
Yeah.
A fun thing, would you, you know how Martin Salinas talks about his house that he had?
Yeah.
He was at the top, where he was just like, each room was a different world. I guess they had this technology for so long that they never thought about the potential of it going down.
Mm-hmm.
But it's sort of like common sense, like, why would you do that? Because, like, your kid, like, your 2-year-old kid, when it went down, could have been millions of light years away.
Right.
But to you, it was just in the room next door. So it's kind of like, would you? I feel like I probably would, if I had the money, have a house like that.
I don't know.
It has to do with, like, the size of the universe. It has shrunk so much for them.
Right.
Whereas, like, for us now, it's still so big and so infinite.
Well, the universe is, but we have shrunk the world with planes and trains and whatnot.
Well, and technology, just, like, being able to talk to
and
your
the
friend,
internet.
Like,
yeah. Yeah, so there's these parallels, definitely, but I don't think so. I don't think I would. I mean, I would probably have used the Farcasters to, like, do vacationing and tourism and stuff, but me personally, I would hope that I would be more paranoid than that and kind of wary of technology. And that's another thing. I know they had it for a long time, but it still upset me that nobody was skeptical enough to like have gone after this and tried to figure it out. Like, how do they work and who's controlling them?
Yeah, well, and I think that's where sort of like the church comes in. Like, it plays such a minor part in these first two books, and we haven't even talked about it.
The Shrike Church?
Yeah, well, both the Shrike Church and the Catholic Church.
Oh, yeah.
You learn much more about them in the next books, but it's interesting that they're kind of like, it's funny to see them as the voice of reason.
Yeah.
And it was very much, you know, when he was writing this in the 90s, it was kind of like a backlash against organized religion.
Yeah.
But then when you read the next two, which you should read, you're going to be like, wait,
How do you actually feel about religion?
It's very clear how he feels. Even in the next two, it becomes even more clear. As different as the two universes are before and after the Farcasters, they are both completely viable options. And it's both fascinating and terrifying.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, this one, you just have the colonial imperialism that we already know.
Right.
The next one, you have something similar, but indoctrination and religion, and you're just kind of like... and then the science and technology and...
Yeah, how do they reconcile all this?
Fascinating. That was probably the coolest part. Like, I think the politics in both novels and the politics of religion and the politics of, like, humanity are just like, what? And that's why he's such a smart author.
Yeah.
I haven't even figured out half of it. So any last thoughts before we go? Although I feel like we did.
Oh, yes, I do have one last side note. The only Technocore guy that you actually get in these two books is Amon. Uman or Amon or whatever.
Oh, that's the greater being.
I thought he was really cool.
Umuman or something? Like that. He's like, I can't translate my name. It's like, Umuman.
Right. Like, yeah, and he's like, he's sort of visualized as this gigantic mountainous like collection of
I imagined of it as a giant things. Brain with like tendrils coming off of it. But in like
I kind of saw it as this sort of, like, rock giant.
Yeah.
Because they're in the whatever data sphere, and everything is sort of being, like, represented to their senses instead of, you know,
actually
empirical.
Happening. Yeah.
I don't know if it was just because, like, the writing was so radically different for him, and the representation was totally, like, out there. Or if it was maybe, like, by that point in the book, I was like, oh, my God, please let there be somebody to explain what's going on. But either way, I thought he was a really cool character, and I thought
you know what he
was,
reminded
like, really
me
well-timed.
Of Treebeard.
Oh yeah,
from The Hobbit.
Totally.
And I was just kind of like, okay, you got this infinite being, you know, Treebeard. He's not necessarily infinite, but his sense of time is infinite.
Yeah,
like the elves.
Yeah. He's so much more kind of powerful and at the same time old.
Yeah, and he's the world. Like he's I mean, he's not so much the world as I think Tom Bombadil is supposed to be the world.
Yeah.
But he's got that experience of the world, whereas like an Umam or Umuman or whatever his name is,
you
and a bunch of M's and O's, he's got that same sense of like the infiniteness of time, and he just, and it was and Simmons' writing comes across as so great because you experience that infiniteness, like you feel tiny. Bronn and
Keats, the first Keats,
the first Keats personality, they're both. They just feel so minuscule.
Right.
And, like, you get the same overwhelming feelings as they do, and you're just kind of like, I want to meet you, but I don't want to meet you.
Yeah.
Like, that type of thing.
The awe and shock and awe.
Yeah. Okay, so this next part, you actually are going to read a passage.
Oh, goody.
So whenever you're ready, you can do that, and then we'll do the question and answer, the quicker portion.
So this is page... 170 in The Fall of Hyperion. The poet paused, the pen stopping, as he realized he could barely see the page. He had been writing in half darkness for some time, and now full darkness had descended. Silenus returned himself in that process of allowing the world to rush in once more, much like the return to the senses following orgasm. Only the descent of the writer to the world was more painful as he or she returned, trailing clouds of glory which quickly dissipated in the mundane flow of sensory trivia. Silenus looked around. The great dining hall was quite dark, except for the fitful glow of starlight and distant explosions through the panes and ivory above. The tables around him were mere shadows, the walls 30 meters away in all directions, darker shadows laced through with varicose darkness of desert creeper. Outside the dining hall, the evening wind had risen, its voices louder now, contralto and soprano solos being sung by cracks in the jagged rafters and rents in the dome above him. The poet sighed. He had no hand torch in his pack. He had brought nothing but water and his kantos. He felt his stomach stir in hunger. Where was that goddamn Bronn Lamia? But as soon as he thought of it, he realized that he was pleased that the woman had not returned for him. He needed to stay in solitude to finish the poem. At this rate, it would take no longer than a day, a night, perhaps. A few hours, and he would be finished with his life's work, ready to rest a while and appreciate the small, daily things, the trivia of living which for decades now had only been an interruption of work he could not complete. Martin Solena sighed again and began setting manuscript pages in his pack. He would find a light somewhere, start a fire if he had to use Sad King Billy's ancient tapestries for kindling. He would write outside by the light of the space battle if he had to. Solena held the last few pages and his pen in hand and turned to look for the exit. Something was standing in the darkness of the hall with him.
So one of the characters that's in that passage you just read, we didn't even talk about King Billy.
Yeah. He's a pretty throwaway minor character.
Simmons wrote great throwaway minor characters.
Yeah, he's so good at that.
Crazy. He's like the epitome of an eccentric royal.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. The reason I picked that one is because that is just that last line.
That's the end of that subplot of Martin Solenis's Kantos, which is a total mirror to this, the series itself. And you have this long scene with it, starting with Martin's story in Hyperion, and carrying out through even other people's stories, kind of have some reference to, especially the overarching plot on Hyperion, like what's going on, and the other characters in what I would call the present time refer to this and have their fates decided almost based on what's happening here.
Yeah, so and he's just such a fascinating character. It's like, as much as he's a dick, he's a fascinating character.
Yeah, Martin.
So it's, you know, he's got this really funny, all these different tropes of science fiction and fantasy have just been pulled in.
Mm-hmm.
But that one, it was the description of the writing at the beginning, and then that last line of what the hell is standing there.
And then there was something with him in the darkness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, it goes on to be like, oh, it must be Bronn. She finally came. And he's like, nope, just kidding. It's the Shrike.
Yeah.
So that works out great. So I've got four final questions.
Okay.
They are general, sort of about you and your reading habits. The first one is, do you own a library card?
Oh my god, no, and I am embarrassed to admit it.
You should be ashamed.
I am.
So ashamed. But to be fair, you had your Tufts library card for a long time.
Yeah. That's true. And I checked out a book as an alumni, so maybe that counts.
Oh, well, if you can still check it out, that does count. But you should support your local library.
Yeah.
Going away from that, when was your first library card, and do you remember?
Oh, goodness. I don't remember my first one specifically. I do remember having a library card in Tacoma, and I went to the library quite a few times. They had this summer reading program, where, you would read books and then, fill out this, chart of how much time you spent reading, and they would have, cool
points and prizes.
Gold stars, basically. Later on in high school, I was really into music, and I was taking music theory classes and all that. I would go to the, downtown library, the good one.
So. Now, have you ever been to the Seattle Public Library? The really big, amazing, beautiful one that they say is,
Yeah, a couple times. It is so nice. Yeah. I would say it's comparable to the Boston Public Library.
Yeah. I will go out there. I will get out there someday. Yeah. Do you own a digital reading device?
I do. I actually have two Kindles, and for the record, I'm against getting unnecessary electronic devices, but my first one broke. The screen cracked, and I look into repairing it, and it was a total pain in the ass. Plus, I really wanted the backlit screen.
Do you prefer digital versus physical books?
I still like physical books for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no substitute for, being able to flip through a book and kind of go back and it's there in your hands. But I think the Kindle, e-readers, not to brand it, are awesome.
Amazon might pay me if we keep saying Kindle.
Maybe. Kindle. For the avid reader and sort of the reader on the go, they make a lot more sense because it's this one little size of a single book, a small single book, and you can have your entire library on there.
So convenient.
And it's backlit again. Yeah. You can read in the dark. And
what about audiobooks?
Love audiobooks.
Ooh, do you?
But I don't really listen to them very much. Listened to a handful of audiobooks, including The Way of the Peaceful Warrior, I think was the last one. It's sort of young man's philosophical journey. It's a pretty good read. And then, of course, the Harry Potter audiobooks.
So what was the last book that you read?
Well, I'm sort of in the middle of Salt World History. But I'm not
I've heard good things
very,
about that.
Yeah, it's good. It's dry. It's nonfiction.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite book or genre? Do you just have an all-time?
I would say sci-fi. My favorite book is probably, it's a book series, but I read it all as one, was Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Got it over there.
Yeah.
I think I've got an omnibus.
Yeah.
Douglas Adams.
The full one. Yeah. Douglas Adams.
So I'm going to read that soon.
Yeah.
And then the final question, if you could make me read one book, what would that be?
Ishmael. If you haven't read it yet.
I haven't. What is that?
Daniel Quinn. It's kind of hard to describe, but it's Gorilla teaches a man what society looks like from the outside.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
To summarize it in one sentence, but it's really good. All and right. It's a pretty quick read.
Yeah, I'll check it out.
Okay.
So that was everything. Check me out on Twitter at Jeff_Whaley and at my blog, The Oddness of Moving Things. I'm pretty sure Mike doesn't do Twitter.
I do not.
He does not do Twitter, so nope. You just have to imagine what he is.
Sorry.
That's bye for now.
Bye, guys.